Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. President Trump will hold a press conference at 3 p.m. live today, and WBUR will have that for you. Meanwhile, we continue our coronavirus coverage. Our Week in Review panelists will join us later in the hour to discuss the week's events. First, some updates from today. Senator Ed Markey and state health and medical leaders held a virtual press conference today, updating people on the state of preparedness. WBUR Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg covered it and joins us now. Carrie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Boy, we've seen a lot of you this week, Carrie.
I know. I'm riding along with you for the long haul.
And we sure appreciate it. So let me ask you, what struck you about today's meeting?
Well, these were people, very lofty people, like the dean of Harvard Medical School, the head of the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association, the head of the Nurses Union, leading researchers, virus experts, and they were not mincing words about being very concerned right now. Here's Dr. Peter Slavin. He's the president of Massachusetts General Hospital.
This is likely to be the most significant public health crisis we're going to face in our lifetimes. But as I reminded the group, our institutions, our community, our country has made it through other public health crises in the past, be it world wars, epidemics, or marathon bombings.
So they're being constructive, they're being hopeful and optimistic, but they're also expressing some very serious concerns.
Carrie, were they specific about what the major problems are?
Yes, I would say that everything's converging now onto two major problems. One is clearly there has not been enough testing. So, you know, it seems like we've been having at best hundreds of tests a day, more like dozens. And what should be happening is more like thousands, according to experts. Although we did hear from Mary Lou Sutters, the Secretary of Health and Human Services of the state today, that this weekend, the state lab will double its capacity to 400 tests a day because it's bringing more automation online. But anyway, so that's problem number one is testing. Problem number two, not enough personal protective equipment. That's the gowns and the masks and the gloves that the frontline healthcare workers wear. And this is very worrying. As one person noted today, you wouldn't send a soldier into battle without the right equipment. And these stocks keep running low. But again, just some reassurance came from state officials that a shipment from the national stockpile of this stuff has just come in. So that's a bit of good news, but there is serious concern about personal protective equipment.
Carrie, you spoke a moment ago about testing, and that has been a huge question. What is the very latest on testing?
So the very latest, what I heard at this press conference was that Massachusetts General Hospital and Brigham and Women's Hospital have started doing some of their own testing. Also, we know that there are private firms, Quest and LabCorp, that are coming online. So again, more reason to expect that testing will be rising in the coming days, but still concerned there's not enough of it happening. Here's Senator Ed Markey.
We are failing on testing. We are at war with the coronavirus right now, and we need an historic wartime effort on testing. We need a manufacturing moonshot that enables and ensures that we can make the test, make them quickly and accurately, ensure that we have all the materials to conduct those tests.
So, Tiziana, a moonshot, a Manhattan Project, an Apollo Project on manufacturing testing. And he's also calling for something similar on manufacturing personal protective equipment, those gowns and masks I was talking about earlier. So he's calling on President Trump both to declare a national emergency, which I gather we expect he may do at 3 o'clock, in order to free up billions of dollars for those efforts and to launch that kind of project.
All right. That's WBUR Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg. Carrie, you're going to stick around and rejoin us for Week in the Review later in the hour, right?
Yes, I will.
Thanks for that. All right, for now, let's turn to schools, where change seems to be happening hourly and families are scrambling to adjust. We are joined now by WBUR Edify editor Kathleen McNerney. Kathleen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Tiziana.
It's great to have you. Let's break it down. Let's do public schools first, then universities, Kathleen. On K through 12, you got Michigan, Ohio, New Mexico, Maryland, Oregon, closing their schools for multiple weeks. What is the status of schools in Massachusetts?
Yeah, there's a lot coming down quickly. No, it's a lot to process for everything, for everyone. So here's what we know so far. Earlier today, Governor Baker said that he is strongly recommending against system-wide closures of schools. He says that closures should be based on the particular situation. For example, if there's a parent or a student with the virus. Now, as I'm sure you know, and many of the listeners know, a lot of districts have been making decisions this week, even today and yesterday, to close for sometimes a matter of weeks as a preventative measure. Many are saying that it is out of an abundance of caution. All right. I was just going to say to the listeners, we are tracking this all on our website, wbur.org/coronavirus. So if help us keep that list up to date, we're trying to provide that service for you.
Perfect. That's perfect. So what do we know, given that there's, you know, that's mixed messages. The state saying one thing, you've got different school districts closing anyway. What do we know as of today about the plans for the Boston Public Schools?
So right now, Boston Public Schools are open, except for one school, which has three campuses, the Elliott School in the North End. There, someone who was in the school recently tested positive for the coronavirus. Mayor Marty Walsh this morning was talking about the situation. Here's what he said.
On Sunday, I will be talking at some point during the day about Boston Public Schools. There will be school Monday. And there'll be school next week, but what we're going to be talking about is laying out a plan for if we have to close the schools and also how we're going to be dealing with our schools moving forward in next week and beyond. And I'll get more into that next week on Sunday. I do not have any answers for you today.
And there's a lot of criticism. There's a change.org petition with over 15,000 signatures right now, people saying they want the schools closed in order to try to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. But Tiziana, I will say for Boston and for many districts, every superintendent that I have talked to, there are a lot of concerns they are trying to balance here. There is, of course, the broader community public health concerns. There are individual student and staff health concerns, both physical and mental. There are food concerns. My colleague Carrie Young is reporting on All Things Considered this afternoon just about this. According to one estimate, there are 300,000 kids in Massachusetts schools who rely on schools to receive breakfast and lunch.
So if they close, the kids may not have access to that food.
Exactly. And I think there's so many layers here. Schools are meeting special needs. Kids have varied home situations. Many are homeless, dealing with trauma. And it's something that district and municipal leaders are keenly aware of the effects of school closures on families overall, over the whole community, both in terms of potential possible exposure to the virus if schools remain open with people coming and going, and on the challenges if families cannot work because they have to stay home or kids are home alone because their parent or guardian has to keep working.
All right, there's a lot there, and I know we'll have continuing conversations about this. I want to shift gears in our last couple minutes to a couple other things. Let's talk colleges and universities. Many here in the state sending their students home, transitioning to online classes. Is there more coming, and how are students reacting to it?
Yeah, again, it has a lot of layers, and I'll try to be concise. We are also tracking this on WBUR.org, and the reaction, the scramble, is real and varied because students have so many different circumstances. My colleagues Fred Tice and Max Larkin have been looking at this. International students are trying to arrange travel. They're struggling with having to go online. Some are looking at Airbnbs, but that's costly. They're looking to stay with friends or relatives in other states. Max Larkin has a great story out today about students who many schools have given a petition process for students to request to stay in the dorms if the dorms are closing. And Max has talked to students who say their petitions were denied and they're really worried. One student saying, you know, worried about heading back to Thailand and the risk of contracting coronavirus through travel or going back to Thailand, but also feeling like he would burden friends if he stayed with them.
So it sounds like we're going to have a number of stories coming up on that from the team, Kathleen. I do want to ask one other question. We've been watching for this for a while, and in a moment of what we might call interesting timing, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education released today its long-awaited review of the Boston Public Schools with an accompanying MOU. Can you just very briefly give us the headlines from that report?
Yep, I have not had a chance to read the whole thing, but here's the top line. In the three-year MOU, the aim is to improve 33 of the district's lowest performing schools. There's a particular focus on supporting students with disabilities and improving student transportation. It includes some kind of resources. I'll be speaking with Superintendent Caselius shortly after I get off with you.
Terrific. And we look forward to watching all of this with you and your team as we go forward. That's WBUR Edify editor Kathleen McNerney. Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you.
All right. Now, among the most awaited news this week has actually been the fate of the Boston Marathon. And here to talk about it is WBUR reporter Alex Ashlock. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
So we got the confirmation this morning that the marathon is postponed to Monday, September 14th for the first time, get this, in 124 years. What went into this decision, Alex?
Incredibly complicated decision because of all the groups that are involved in the marathon, the cities and towns that host the course. You've got the city of Boston. You've got the state of Massachusetts. It wasn't the Boston Athletic Association's decision to make. They had to work with all these other entities. And I think what it really came down to is they just ran into a situation where they didn't have much choice because so many other cities were banning these large events like the Boston Marathon. And as you said, it's the first time this has happened in 124 years of the Boston Marathon. Here's Governor Baker on the decision today.
The House and the Senate both said that to not run the marathon at all would be an incredibly distressing decision, in part because it's a great event, in part because it's a big boon to the local economy, but also just because of the symbolism and the significance that that race represents.
It's interesting because other marathons are making similar decisions. London just today canceled their marathon, which is April 26, right after Boston, and then they moved it to October 4th. So they're also recognizing, like Boston, just the importance culturally and economically of these huge events that are being held in their cities.
So, Alex, the fall calendar is pretty, really crowded. So how on earth did they find a date where they could move the Boston Marathon?
You've got the summer ending, Labor Day, college move-ins at that time of year, the Jewish holidays in later September, and all these other marathons I just mentioned. So right now in September, you have the Berlin Marathon. That's the 27th. October's been moved to, or London's been moved to October 4th. Chicago's October 11th. New York is November 1st. So there's just all these things going on, and they think they just came down to a time that they could settle on. And it might not be perfect for everyone, but that's the day they settled on, September 14th.
You know, I realized just now, I don't know this. How long does one need for recovery between two marathons? Do you know?
Well, you can't really do, the elite runners don't do, they're not going to be doing all four of those marathons.
Okay.
They won't even do two of them. The wheelchair athletes, on the other hand, can do London and Boston, which are only a week apart. So some of those athletes will probably do, you know, more than one of these marathons. And there's a lot of money involved for those elite athletes participating in these big marathons.
All right, sticking with the runners for a minute. Some runners, including a couple of our own colleagues here at WBUR, have been training to run this marathon. I know this weekend's supposed to be a big run.
It was supposed to be.
Yeah, so what does this mean for people who've been training?
Well, you just have to put your training not on hold necessarily, but maybe just consider this sort of a speed bump. Marathon training periods are usually 18 weeks, 4 months roughly. And I think what would we have 5 months between April and September? So it's almost like they're going to go through two training cycles in order to get ready for the new date of the marathon in September. Here's what Tom Grilk, he's the chief executive officer of the Boston Athletic Association. Here's the message he had for runners today.
It is inspiring to see all of these cities and towns and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts come together to find a way to keep the Boston Marathon going for 2020.
And it is important to keep it going, right, Alex?
Sure.
I mean, Marathon brings a million people into the region every spring, generates over $200 million in tourist spending. Then there's tens of millions in charitable donations. What are the financial implications of not doing it in April and doing it later?
Well, one of the implications might be that the charities will end up raising way more money than they usually do, because people who are signed up right now to run the marathon and they're signed up with a charity, they're just going to keep raising money. And they raise $40 million a year. So that figure could probably be even bigger
by
September. So maybe there's a good benefit there. And Mayor Walsh was talking today about making that weekend in September sort of a way to help local businesses recover from, you know, what might happen, what's already happened economically, and what might happen by September, because who knows where we'll be in September with regard to COVID-19 and the economic situations there. And as I mentioned, you know, they're going to continue to raise money for charity. So
what about
we'll
if you can't run in September?
That's
though?
A good question. I asked Tom Grilk that question today, and they've been focused on how to reschedule the marathon rather than thinking about, well, what about the runners who can't run in September? They haven't made a plan for that. I have to think that they'll let those people defer to next year eventually. That's just my speculation, because that's what other marathons have done when similar decisions have been made. You might remember after the bombing in 2013, there were something like 5,000 runners who didn't finish. They let those people come back and run in 2014.
And we didn't postpone in 2014.
That's
and
right.
I say that because this race is 124 years old. It's got a long history. It is really a part of the soul of Boston. You know this race well. What does it mean to the city and the region that we are taking this step?
You know, I'm having a hard time thinking about how to answer that question, because it was so different in 2013 and 14. After the bombing, I don't think there was really any conversation about canceling the marathon the next year. But we're in sort of this weird, uncharted situation where we've got this virus, this sickness. It's March. We don't even really know what April 20th, will it even look like? Is it going to go on for months? We just really don't know. So I think, you know, the Patriots Day weekend is such a big event, a great weekend in the city. We may still be dealing with COVID-19 on April 20th. That might be the focus. And, hopefully by the time we get to September 14th, this will all be over. People can focus on the marathon and having a good time in the city.
Let's hope that that's the case.
I hope so.
That is WBUR's Alex Ashlock. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. It's Friday, which means it's time for our Week in Review, and this week was all about the coronavirus, and it continues to be. Today, Governor Baker put a hold on large gatherings.
We just issued guidance that will prohibit gatherings of over 250 people in the Commonwealth, effective immediately.
That follows his declaration of a state of emergency in Massachusetts this week. President Trump will hold a press conference today at 3. WBUR will carry it for you live. Trump says federal and state governments are united in one effort.
You know, the states are a smaller form of government. They can control individual arenas and individual things better. And it's different for different areas. Some areas have no problem whatsoever in our country, and others do.
And everyone is feeling the impact, from professional sports to the local economy, especially as area students head home.
I mean, losing them from June till mid-August, you know, we deal with that almost every season. But losing them now until next September, that's a hit.
We're feeling it, too. Our Week in Review panelists aren't in studio today. We're asking everybody to join us from afar. But still with us to take stock from afar are Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor. Welcome, Renee.
Thank you.
Also joining us via Skype is Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Welcome back, Ed.
Good to be back.
And rejoining us from the top of the hour is WBUR Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg. Carrie, thanks for staying with us.
Sure, no problem.
And you, how are you coping with the coronavirus crisis? How has it impacted you day to day in your work? What are your thoughts on the public health response? And what more do you think needs to be done? Share your concerns and thoughts with us. Join us in reflection. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, let's jump in. I want to start with the government response and with President Trump. The president expected to declare a state of emergency, a national state of emergency today, most likely. What do you make of where we are now, Renee?
You know, I'm wondering what took him so long. You know, I'm glad he's finally getting around to that. But I mean, I feel like we've been in a state of emergency for at least the last week. And if you think about what was happening in Boston at the beginning of this week with the cancellation of the St. Patrick's Day parade and some of the other changes people have made, where a lot of offices have told people, if you can work home, we'd rather that you do so. You know, I think we've been in this state for a while. So as usual, it really feels like this administration is behind the curve.
Ed Lyons, what leadership do you want to see from the president of the United States this week in this moment?
I think I want him to start solving problems to give the states what they need. Governor Baker says he needs things in the federal government. I hope that they would give those things to Governor Baker so we can make progress here. That's what I want to see that Trump doing is handling actual problems.
And do you feel like he's been doing that so far, Ed?
No, it's been terrible. I can't believe. I had a friend at work today who said he couldn't believe how we have this great country and all these public health resources, but our response has been so poor the past couple of months. It's just shameful, and I agree.
Kerry Goldberg, have we heard comments from the state government level, whether from the governor's office or Department of Public Health, about how they're feeling about the Trump administration's response, or have they been silent?
Well, Governor Baker yesterday did say, look, we need to be able to do more testing. This is our top priority from the federal government. So there's been a bit of a crescendo from the state officials who initially were not particularly pointing fingers, and now they are.
I'd like to listen to something Governor Baker said today about the response so far.
Waiting to act and allowing infections and subsequent number of people who need medical attention to spike all at once would not only severely hamper our hospital's ability to care for those who need to be cared for, but will have a far greater economic impact in the future as well.
Renee Graham, what is your reaction to the state-level public health response this far?
Well, you know, I don't always agree with the governor, but he's absolutely right. You know, you have to have a sense of how big the crisis is, and you can only do that if you can do testing. And the fact that states have not been able to do that, it's been really detrimental to tracking how this virus is going. And also it's a threat to public health. So, you know, I think the states have been stepping up. I think it was wise of the state to look and say, look, we can't have the Boston Marathon, which I know it pains them no end to have to cancel that or to postpone it until the fall, but they really had no choice. I think, you know, what has been happening is the states have had to step up in the absence of federal guidance to take care of its citizens in the way that the Trump administration just hasn't been doing.
Ed, the Trump, President Trump himself attacked the CDC in some tweets today, a couple of tweets, really going after a previous CDC performance, anchoring that to President Obama, but essentially undermining the CDC today as well. How does one think about that? Is there separate accountability between the president and the CDC?
No. For the average citizen, it's, you know, it's the government. I don't think this kind of squabbling and attacks is completely wrong. I don't think it matters what President Trump thinks about the CDC. I think it matters that he starts helping the country.
Renee, you wanted to add something to that.
Well, look, the CDC is a federal agency and Trump is the president. And, you know, we can certainly talk about cuts he made to the CDC's budget 2 years ago. But the fact is that, you know, we don't need finger pointing now. We need action. And so, you know, Trump is so busy trying to deflect blame and make it seem like, oh, it's fault of the CDC and oh, it's President Obama's fault, which is his favorite thing to do, which is blame his predecessor. I think it's sort of absurd when people need answers now on what he is doing right now to deal with this crisis.
I'd like to take some calls.
And Tiziana,
go ahead, Kerry.
Yeah, there is no one, I would argue, who inspires more confidence right now than Tony Fauci, who's kind of running the show at the CDC. He's been in this kind of high public health position for more than 30 years. He's been through epidemic after epidemic. And if anybody knows what they're doing, he does. And so I think that he is, you know, he's a figure of authority and inspiring confidence in a way that really almost no one else in the federal government is in terms of knowing epidemics.
Yeah, Kerry, he really does seem to have been sort of become the symbol of straight talking medical knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, here's where
with
we
that
are.
Brooklyn accent.
Yeah, I mean, I hear about him everywhere. Renee, Ed, what is your reaction to the role that Fauci's been playing?
Well, I think it's been invaluable. He's been able to keep things on track. You know, when the president is saying, oh, anyone can get tests anytime, and he's saying, yeah, that's not the case. We've needed not just a voice of reason through this. We need a voice of truth. And that's what Anthony Fauci has been.
All right. The calls are coming in. Fast and Furious, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Julie's on the line. Julie, are you calling from Logan Airport?
No, actually, I just pulled over at a rest stop on the turnpike. I just landed at Logan from about 9 days in Greece.
Wow. So, Julie, what is on your mind? I mean, you're like living it right now.
Well, we use lots of hand sanitizer in Greece, and we had a wonderful time. I was on a group tour. Coming home, I was surprised that there were no announcements made about the CDC recommendations for returning travelers from Europe to self-quarantine for 14 days. And so that's the message I want to get out. That's the reason I'm calling.
Yeah.
I'm calling to encourage all returning travelers from Europe to do that, to follow the CDC recommendations, to stay home for 14 days, to self-quarantine out of an abundance of caution, but those are the recommendations. And from what I've heard, the messaging is going to be going out starting tomorrow, but as you know, we've got a lot of American travelers returning home today. And so my concern was that that message has not gotten out.
Thank you, Julie. You know, it has now gotten to all of our listeners. And if you are traveling back, the CDC is asking people to self-quarantine for 14 days. Before we turn to our panelists, I want to add one more call in here. We've got Joseph calling from Franklin, Massachusetts. Joseph, go ahead.
Hello there. Thank you for the time.
Yeah.
I'm a service contractor, electrician, self-employed, and I just left someone's house whose son goes to Babson College, and there was a player on his team that is getting tested for COVID-19, and the results are not going to come back till tomorrow. But meanwhile, the homeowner tells me that, but am I not supposed to go back in and see my 18-month-old daughter right now? I'm standing in my driveway, don't even know if I should go in.
Wow, Joseph, I'm so sorry for that stress. And just to clarify, the person who's being tested was on the same sports team as the son or just at the same university?
Same team.
Okay. Carrie, any thoughts for Joseph based on what we know the guidance to be? I know this is a high-stakes situation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just so can't wait until we actually have testing. I was speaking with someone yesterday who is saying, you know, his wife is flying back from Brazil and he would want her to get tested before being with their toddler. And so where can you get a test? And I think we're on the verge of that, on the verge of being able to have more available testing, but we just don't have it yet. And so I would say call your doctor if you're wondering. And of course, you try to avoid catching it yourself by washing your hands and keeping your distance and so on. And it is supposed to spread by aerosolized droplets, right? So if no one was coughing but on the other hand, also we have news today that it apparently can remain on surfaces for a bit. So it's a tough one. Ask your doctor.
Yeah, Joseph, I am not a medical professional in any way, but having listened to calls and answers all week, if you have a doctor, I would encourage you to call your doctor and ask them before you head back into the house. And again, we'll be thinking about you. We hope everybody's going to be safe and okay. Renee and Ed.
Tiziana,
yeah,
Carrie. I could add just one thing. At a state press conference today, they said that they were bringing in a new line, a 211 line for coronavirus questions. I haven't tried it yet, but it is supposed to be up and running.
Excellent. So, Joseph, that might be a place to call as well. Carrie, that's very useful. Thanks. So, Ed and Renee, we've been hearing calls like Joseph's all week. What is the level of question and cloud that people are living under day to day as they try to figure out how to navigate life in what seems to be likely to be the new normal?
I feel like what I don't understand is, you know, the Daily Beast had a story earlier today talking about the reaction in the NBA to Rudy Gobert being testing positive for coronavirus.
That's the Utah Jazz player, right?
Right, the Utah Jazz player. In the state of Oklahoma, where they were, they got 58 tests and the results within a matter of hours yesterday.
How does that happen?
Exactly. How does that happen?
Must be nice.
But you have this gentleman who called and he's worried and you know about what's going to happen to him. Why are we having this have and have nots, which is always a problem in America, that some people can get the test with no delay and other people can't?
Ed, anything you want to add before I grab a couple more calls?
I think we have to focus on things we can control. I think we can say we're going to keep our distance from people. We're going to wash our hands. We're going to be mindful about our breathing and coughing. And I think we should focus as much as we can on what we can do. We'll be constantly confronted with things until our government gets its act together. And until then, let's just do the right thing ourselves. That's probably the best thing we can do.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's try to get a couple calls here. Michael from Cambridge, go ahead and share your thoughts.
My name is Michael Payne. I'm a physician, regrettably easy name to remember, in the Cambridge area.
That's a good point.
I think that a couple of things that have become very obvious and have been in the news recently and should be seriously listened to, and you alluded to it yourself. We're in a new normal. Most of us within our lifetime have never experienced an epidemic of this type. We've not lived through a pandemic. You know, those who are still survivors of the 1918 epidemic, and few and far between, went through something like this. And the reality is that we're very much like that epidemic in that we don't have a vaccination, we don't have effective medications, and we don't have good testing now. Now, testing is coming online, and it will come online slowly and, you know, intermittently at different places. My hospital, Cambridge Health Alliance, has just begun making tests available. But, again, there's an issue of supply. We just don't have that many. So we're pretty much taking the 1918 playbook about this virus.
Wow.
And it was made very clear that what worked when you don't have medicines and you don't have vaccines and you have a virus that no one on Earth has ever been exposed to before, so it will go through our population like a scythe through wheat, is you have the science and you have common sense. The science says...
No, Michael, I'm sorry. I got to stop you there. I value your comments, but I've got a full line of calls. And I want to point out, I think the ultimate thing there is the common sense piece, which is what we've been talking about, you know, self-quarantine, social distancing, et cetera. I want to grab one more call here. Amy from Roslindale. Amy, please go ahead.
Hi, yes, thank you. I'm a pediatrician, and I am concerned about the response of the Boston Public Schools. I have two children in the Boston Public Schools, and I'll need to be working, taking care of patients, so it's not like I want them home, but I think the right thing to do is to close the Boston Public Schools. We need to do everything we can to slow down the spread of this virus so that our health systems don't get completely overwhelmed like they did in Italy, where doctors are having to ration who gets the ventilators that they have available.
Okay, that's a terrifying thought, Amy, and I appreciate your point. Ed Lyons, what do you make of the disconnect between the fact that Governor Baker today is saying, you know, we're not asking for district-wide school closing the morning after many, many districts closed schools?
Well, the governor has to balance many kinds of things. You know, a school is not the same thing in every community. In some places, it is the only food and health care children get. Schools serve a variety of community needs. And I think that this is going to take a long time. A school shouldn't close a week before it needs to if there's no cases nearby. There must be contingency plans for people to get these services at the schools. It's not easy for us to think in our own expertise about the myriad factors that make our lives work. We need to rely on experts who can think of all of these things. And there's a reason why the governor said, you know, only these schools, not those schools, because people are really trying to work out these very important details that are as important as the virus in some cases.
And Renee Graham, just quickly, how do we balance the competing claims? For example, we've heard a lot of very important concern about kids in schools who may not have enough food at home without being at school, may not have enough supervision at home, with the public health concerns about spread. How are we supposed to think about that?
You know, I can certainly see both sides of the argument, and I understand, you know, why the governor and other officials are grappling with this. If you close the schools, then yes, you take a step towards stopping the spread, but it also creates an incredible hardship for so many families who don't have the resources to have other places for their kids to be cared for, can't take time off from work. We've talked about how many kids in Massachusetts are dependent on lunch and breakfast in schools for meals, because meals they wouldn't get otherwise. And what's going to happen to them in the meantime? I can understand both sides of the argument. I'm glad I don't have to make that decision.
Yeah.
But I think it's too easy for people to simply say, well, you just need to close the schools, because that doesn't take into consideration, as I said, the extraordinary hardship this is going to inflict on a lot of families.
We're going to need to take a break in a minute.
Ooh, can I just?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Can
Carrie.
I add one thing?
Yeah.
If we have time. Just that I think the fascinating thing here is that the one good thing you can say about this virus is that it doesn't tend to target kids. So we're not talking about the safety of the children. We're talking about the schools contributing to the efforts to flatten the curve. That makes it a little more complicated.
We are continuing our week in review on the coronavirus. Now, President Trump will hold a press conference at 3 p.m. and WBUR will have that live for you. Meanwhile, we have our panelists here. Still with us on the line is Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks, Renee.
Thank you.
Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Hey there again, Ed.
Hello.
And Carrie Goldberg, Common Health Editor here at WBUR. Hey, Carrie.
Hey there.
And the calls have been continuing to come in as they have all week, and I'd like to keep talking to callers. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We want you at the table. Join our conversation. Teresa is on the line from Jamaica Plain. Teresa, please go ahead.
Hi. This is Dr. Teresa Spillane. I'm a psychologist in Jamaica Plain and perhaps more importantly, the mother of 22-year-old triplets, who are two of whom are at Harvard and mourning the loss of their senior year, their senior spring. But more importantly, I'm calling because I have some suggestions for families with young children in terms of coping with prolonged absences from school. I would suggest, both as a psychologist and a mom, is to try and keep a consistent schedule for your kids. Try to approximate the rhythm of a typical school day. You know, maintain mealtimes and bedtimes. Young kids crave routine and will feel safer if they have a predictable schedule and feel that their parents will keep them safe. Give information only on a need-to-know basis and follow your kids' lead. Don't over-inform them. It's just going to create anxiety.
Teresa, I'm going to interrupt you there and ask you one very specific question. If your kid says, "Why am I not at school?" what is it that a parent should say to a child about why they're not at school right now?
It depends on the age, but for most kids, younger children, you can say, "You're not at school now because grown-ups want to keep everybody safe and healthy. And one of the ways we're doing that is that we're going to keep everybody home from school for a while."
Okay, we're going to take it for you from you from there, Teresa. Thank you. That was really helpful information. Ed Lyons, I know you are, you know, deeply engaged with your family, very much a family man. How are you talking about this with your family?
Well, my kids are, what, 3, 7, and 9? So I've just told them what's happening, that they know what germs are and that we are all in this together and that we have to take care of each other and, you know, that we have to do this. And, you know, they know a little bit about government. And I told them we have a great government. We have the best public health community in the world. And we should be proud of the fact we have good people making decisions. And when there's a big decision made, I explain how it was made. And they generally have good morale. So I'm very pleased.
Let's grab a couple more calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Matthew's on the line from South Boston. Matthew, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just can't believe how this is really blown up. I mean, with the fear, I think that's our biggest problem. I wish it wouldn't have to be, you know, 24 hours a day on the television. I think everyone's got to keep in mind, it's not as if they have like 10 million, a stockpile of 10 million doses or tests for this virus. It's a new virus. And you know what? I got to give the president credit. I didn't vote for him, but I got to give him credit. I remember right from the beginning, back in January, he started acting on this. They've been doing what they could do.
You know? All right, we're going to take it from there, Matthew. Thank you. You know, Renee, we here at Radio Boston have been covering coronavirus in depth all week. And it is a regular conversation among us. What's the right balance so that we give people the information that they need without sort of ginning up panic by the level of emphasis? Have you been thinking about that? And what do you think that balance is?
You know, I have thought about it. There's a lot of moving parts, but I think there's also a lot of information people need to have, and that is changing by the hour. So I think it's good to know if you are planning a vacation where you should and shouldn't be going, or whether your kid's school district is going to stay open. I think those are things people do need to know. You know, look, you know, people can tune out any way they want to. You can, you know, TVs do turn off. You can get off the internet. Those are things you can do. But I think the information that's out there, I think is out there for a good reason. People do want to know, where are the tests? Where, how can I get tested? What's going to happen? I think we need this flow of information because, and I, it might feel like it's a deluge at this point because there wasn't that much at first. We were hearing about China. We were hearing about Italy. But, you know, as people might recall, last month, the president was still saying this was a hoax. So it wasn't really getting as much attention at that time when it probably should have been, when maybe we could have gotten ahead of this. So I think now, when you are having these instances where the numbers are going up in the states, that people are paying more attention, I think people are thankful for the information.
And Carrie Goldberg, you know, you've been following this story very closely. Have you heard comments in the world of public health and in the world of healthcare about whether or not you, sort of the public conversation is striking the right balance and the right note?
Well, most of the comments are more about making sure that the information that goes out is correct and accurate and counters the misinformation that's floating around all over the place. I agree. It feels like it's 24/7. It certainly feels that way for me. But I would say that that's kind of inevitable when you have a phenomenon that is affecting the very fabric of our lives. It's affecting where we go and what we do and how we interact with other people. And so it's a combination of needing to know what's going on and then needing to know how to translate that into our own actions. And so that is a recipe for wall-to-wall coverage.
I want to shift gears now to the economy. Listeners, let me ask you, do you own a business? Are you working from home? Are you worried about everything from your local restaurants and small business owners to the future of your company? How are you feeling about the relationship between the coronavirus and the economy? 1-800-423-8255. Boston's taking extreme measures to contain the spread of the virus, and that includes closing some kinds of, or restricting businesses, closing down cultural institutions. Colleges are sending students home. There are events being canceled. Here's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh yesterday on how he views the likely economic impact.
This is going to have at least for the next 2 to 3 to 4 months, a major impact on our economy and on individuals.
And businesses say that they are already hurting. Tim Athanasidis, the owner of the Asperia Grill in Brighton, is worried as students leave the city.
If we lose these kids, I mean, losing them from June till mid-August, you know, we deal with that almost every season. But losing them now until next September, yeah, that's a hit. That is a good blow to the, especially the small business community.
And in fairness to, I'm going to say that again, Athanasiades. Sorry about that, Tim. And yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it plunged 10%. Worst session since 1987. Seems to be rebounding some today. Speaking of new normal, Ed Lyons, are we going to be bouncing all over the map nationally, and are we going to be deeply hurting locally?
I don't know. I think we are going to hurt a bit locally. I think that for people who don't die from this, I think the economic consequences will be the strongest for them. And I think I really hope our government can organize at every level to help people out of these problems, to maybe let the whole country skip a mortgage and a rent payment. I don't know how we do that, but I think it's time that we figure out how we're all going to get through this in terms of just surviving. And I don't have the answers, but I hope people start thinking about that.
Renee Graham, one of the things that I've seen in the last few days is an increasing set of emails from nonprofit organizations talking about how they're responding. And it's an interesting blend of we have to increase our services in some ways. We have to decrease our services due to exposure in other ways. And we're, you know, concerned about the long-term support and sustainability of our organizations. How hard is this going to be to navigate in our for-profit and nonprofit sectors?
You know, I think for everyone, because this is so unprecedented, everyone's sort of making this up as they go along and trying to figure out what's the best path to take. And it's not always going to be the right path. It's just everyone is just struggling right now. And, you know, I think people are just trying to figure it out as best they can, because we have, you know, we don't have a roadmap for this at all. And I think that's the hardship in this for a lot of people. It is terrible. I think a lot of there are nonprofits that are going to go under. I think that there are businesses that are already suffering. And it needs to be said that Chinatowns, including Boston's, has been suffering even before cases really started happening here. And that was purely out of racism. In Boston, businesses in Chinatown, the restaurants, it's down 80%. And so, and that has nothing to do with anything except racism. So that needs to be addressed as well. But now you add in all these other businesses, like businesses around the garden, businesses around Fenway Park, that are going to lose customers because the sporting events have been suspended.
Yeah, just to remind listeners, the NBA has suspended, the NHL has suspended, MLB has postponed, Major League Soccer has suspended, just in case listeners didn't know. Renee, go ahead.
Right. So if you have a business in the North End, this is your sweet season because you've got basketball and hockey, and now you don't have that. So, you know, it's a lot of people are going to figure it out, and not everybody's going to come out of this hole. I do think that that's where the federal government does need to step in and especially do something for these small businesses. These are mom and pop stores and businesses that aren't going to survive this because they're losing too much money suddenly.
Carrie Goldberg, this makes me wonder, you know, you may not have an answer for this, but as you've been covering this and you've been at press conferences and conversations, has there been any conversation about how to provide for the collective mental and emotional well-being of our communities under this incredible strain?
Well, there is a task force that's being created on equity as it relates to the coronavirus, but not overall mental health. And I do keep thinking about that. Like, just in the last couple of years, there's been this very strong public health push saying that, you know, isolation kills, loneliness is bad for you, make sure you have social connection. And now we have this event where you're supposed to be apart, away from all the people that, or most of the people that you normally interact with. So it's definitely an added burden. And I think we're just heading into coping with it.
Ed, any additional thoughts on that? You know, especially many of our civil society institutions are telling people to stay home now. Even religious institutions are saying this, you know, this is not the time to be in close proximity. So where do people turn for their, you know, overall human well-being?
Well, they can talk out their windows. I probably plan on putting a table and chairs in my front lawn. We can all sit in front of our houses and porches and talk to each other.
I like that idea.
I think it's time for us to get creative about our own communities, about what we can do. If it's safe to eat in restaurants, in general it is, as long as you're not close to somebody. If it's safe to walk around, then we can all talk to our neighbors. I think we have to start doing more of that, finding ways to find something positive in all this, to discover our communities more, are more about our children and our neighbors. I think we should, amidst all the suffering, we have to find some sort of morale to keep going. We have to look for these positive things we can be doing while we're going through all this.
Renee Graham, in our last minute or so, I want to shift gears one more time because there is a presidential primary season and election playing out. There is a political dimension to this, whether it makes us comfortable or not. We saw Senator Sanders and Vice President Biden yesterday make public comments. What are you watching for? There's a debate this weekend. Louisiana just postponed its Democratic presidential primary for April 4th. What are you watching for in the next few weeks on that front?
You know, I obviously think the virus is going to be front and center in the debate on Sunday, because I think it's a way for them to sort of really appear presidential and to have ideas. And I'm going to have a task force. And that's what part of their speeches were about yesterday. So I think, you know, you can't really remove the political dimension from this. And I do think this is a time when the country is looking for compassion and leadership. And I think that's what both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden are going to try to project on Sunday.
Ed, one last comment from you.
I don't think they should have the debate at all. We've been watching these two old men for our entire lives. Having them get up there and talk is completely meaningless. I hope they don't do that. I hope that we can just focus on getting voting to keep happening peacefully, that we're ready for November. Our politics needs work to make sure that it happens. We don't need another debate from these men.
All right. That was Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist. Thanks, Ed.
You're welcome.
Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks, Renee.
Thank you.
And WBUR's Carrie Goldberg. Thanks, Carrie.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a special hour of Radio Boston today. Stay tuned to WBUR for President Trump's press conference at 3. The president is expected to speak on the coronavirus. We are a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again on Monday. Thanks.